Thank you for coming to the second panel of the day. My name is Bruce Williams. I'm the director of the Institute of Communications Research in the College of Communications. And my charge was to introduce the panelists, but when I look at the panelists, I realize the only person that needs introducing is me. Since you really didn't come to hear about my story, I will be really brief. Each of the panelists will speak for 20 minutes, although Naomi has volunteered to speak for only 15 because she spoke last night. And then we want to leave as much time for questions as possible. But we do have to end on time. So the panelists are, in the order that they will be speaking, Phil Donahue, obviously the host of The Phil Donahue Show, a television show that ran from 1967 to 1996. And really invented the talk show platform on television. And I looked this up, and I assume this is not a misprint. Phil has won 19 Emmy Awards. Our next speaker will be Naomi Klein, who many of you heard last night, is a columnist for The Nation magazine, the author of No Logo, a path-breaking book, and Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate. And then our last speaker, but not least, is John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation. He's the co-author with Bob McChesney of Our Media, Not Theirs, and he has a new book out called Against the Beast, which is a history of American opposition to empire. And with that, I will turn it over to Phil Donahue.
Thank you. Well, thank you. I will begin by doing what I do better than anyone else on earth, talk about myself. I graduated from the University of Notre Dame in 1957. That means that this December, I will turn 70. And thank you. I think I feel that I've made an achievement. In 1959, I was 22 years old, and I got a job at WABJ radio station in Adrian, Michigan, as a news director. I was the news director because I was the only person in the news department. I had a Norelco tape recorder with vacuum tubes, long before solid-state technology. And it was a suitcase and a microphone that said WABJ on it. And I could stop. I was 22. I looked 12. And I could stop the mayor in the middle of the hallway. I began to appreciate the power of journalism. I was amazed at how powerful I was. And the opportunity I had at WABJ, I don't remember how many watts, probably 500. I don't think it was a proverbial 250 watt. I was amazed. I covered City Hall, the City Commission. I remember getting thrown out, the heady experience of being thrown out of a commissioner's office because he didn't like my question. I played softball with the cops so I could cultivate my sources. I covered my first murder. I covered the prosecutor's office. This was a fabulous opportunity to learn how a city works, how journalism works. I got stories wrong, and I was humiliated for what happened. I wrote the stories, and I broadcast them on the radio. And my station announced the Friday night football, high school football scores. There are no such radio stations like this anymore. These radio stations are now computers at which place nobody works. They beam canned, pureed music prepared at another location through the computer to the local market. This is the opposite of localism. You can't get the Friday night score of the high school football game. How many radio stations are broadcasting that now? There are several students in our assembly here. You will not have this AAA opportunity to try and make your way to the big leagues. No such farm teams exist anymore for you. So we have to ask ourselves, how many young people are having the opportunity I had to get wet, get immersed, cover the cops, cover the prosecutor's office, report a scandal? We had the cops, apparently we had 10 cops and only 3 of them could hit the target, forget the middle of the target. I mean, this was just the beginning of my experience with news and what it meant and how powerful and how important it was to the community and to the culture, to the nation in which I live. Now, you know, it used to be, how many could you own? One company. Now, we have one company owning more than 1,200 radio stations, most of them computers. Then Phil Donahue became a newsman in Dayton, Ohio. I really moved up big time. Boy, I tell you what, I had a cameraman, and we just covered everything that moved. And I'd run to the fire, and I'd say, what did it look like when you got here, Chief? And the chief say, well, it looked like a fire dummy. What do you think? You know, what do you think it was? And suddenly, in the early 60s, talk radio hit. You could actually call a radio station and be on the air. Well, what an opportunity was this. And I arranged to have the telephone company give me the equipment that allowed me to have other people, guests from long distance. So you didn't have to come to Dayton to be on Conversation Piece, 1 to 2:30 in the afternoon, WHIO AM radio, Dayton, Ohio. I had Bobby Kennedy. I had Marguerite Oswald. I had some huge people because they didn't have to come to Dayton to be on. And I could connect these 20th century political figures with housewives in Dayton, mostly the audience then, who would call in to Conversation Piece. And the ratings went through the roof. Dayton, Ohio had never heard anything like this before. And I was asked to do the same thing on television. And in 1967, the Donahue Show, Phil Donahue Show, was born. Two cameras, women seated on folding chairs, very little budget, no band, no desk, no couch, no announcer who laughed at my jokes. We were a visually boring television program. And we were up against Monty Hall, who was giving $5,000 to a woman dressed like a chicken salad sandwich on Let's Make a Deal. And we knew in order to make this fly, we had to have issues. Issues is the only thing that's going to save us. And so we booked Madeline Murray O'Hare, the atheist. There's no God, there's no heaven, there's no hell. When you die, you go in the ground, and you biodegrade, and the worms eat you, and that's the nature of life on Earth as we know it today. Well, my dear, the whole town came down on the Donahue Show, and everybody in town knew that there was a new television program on WHIO at that time. And we inherited an audience from the preceding show. And the women in the audience, mostly women then, we're asking better questions than the host. So one day I just did the genius thing of jumping out of the chair and walking into the audience, and women were standing up and asking some fabulous questions and proving that they cared more, and the sexism was very, very large then, huge. Women only cared about covered dishes and needlepoint, housewives. I mean, you can't imagine the bias that existed in television management land at that time, as evidenced by the programming that surrounded us. It was all game shows and soap operas. That's all there was on daytime television. Here comes Donahue with Madeline Murray O'Hare. And then we put our first OBGYN on. Holy cow, the phones just smoked with women. And the pill had recently been introduced. And I found myself sitting there. We couldn't get to the questions fast enough. Why am I bloating? Why is the pill making me feel this way? I would sit there while a woman would go on and on with the doctor talking about an itch. And suddenly, everybody in Dayton was talking about the Donahue Show. And our first full year on the air was 1968. Bobby Martin, Chicago. And I had a platform for discussion with my name on it. This should happen to everybody. We had a woman on whose daughter was a student at Yellow Springs Antioch College, who was arrested at a Vietnam War protest and was fasting in the Greene County Jail, and the women in the audience were hysterical at this mother. What if she dies? And the mother would say, why aren't you concerned about the 300 young men coming home from this war in Southeast Asia in body bags every week? And it was, those were the numbers then. A week, 300, 350 a week. And then the other woman at the other side of the audience would scream at this woman. And I remember this is the day before the wireless mic. I mean, really, I feel like Father Time. And, you know, getting from one end of the studio to the other, you know, the wire would go across a lady in the front row. And the women in the audience would be screaming at each other. And then Jane Fonda came on the Donahue Show. Literally. With a tie-dye T-shirt and a lot of young kids who, you know, one of whom said, man, I got some great weed here, dude. You want to, really, these were the flower children. But they were people with a conscience. And women were calling Jane Fonda and saying, why does she do this? She's embarrassing her father. And why doesn't she go back to Hollywood and just be a good girl and act in movies and shut up and sing? And Bob Evans, the farm sausage guy, wrote a letter and it said, I will not sponsor any programs that tear down America. Very simple for Bob Evans. Shut up. Stop protesting. Stop the dissent. The problem at the time, and he canceled, our luck was that we had become an 800-pound gorilla. Our ratings were sensational. They didn't know what to do with us. We put people on who criticized General Motors. We got away with everything. We did have stations that canceled, that would not. I remember a station in Arizona owned by Gene Autry would not carry a Donahue Show that featured Dick Gregory. These are some of the strange things along the way. But if Peoria canceled, I was still on the air in Indianapolis. It was the honest way to come up. No one vice president of a network could cancel me while he was shaving in the morning. We built it the honest way, brick by brick, market by market. And if somebody got fed up with us, we could go across the street and sell the program to the other competing station. A fabulous democratic way to grow a television program. And so after 29 years and over 6,000 shows, and if you think I'm bragging, I am. By the way, of those in that time, the most oft-visited guest, the most oft-featured guest, was Ralph Nader, who, by the way, drew a very large crowd for me. I paid no price for featuring Ralph Nader. People wanted to hear what he had to say. I mean, Ralph Nader, talked about the second crash. Your children are eggs rattling around in the crate of these cars with dashboards that have protrusions that will knock the eye socket out. And this doesn't have to be. You can have a car that's safe in the second crash. And I lived with him throughout the latter part of the 20th century as he begged Detroit to put in seatbelts. And they resisted, and they resisted, and they resisted, and they hated them. And now, seatbelts are a feature of the advertising of automobiles. They help sell cars. And most recently, to bring my odyssey to a close, I went back to cable television because I just couldn't believe, the cable media support for this war. You're looking at a real naive guy. I mean, first of all, I'm spoiled. I had all those years of pretty much doing whatever I wanted to do. I mean, really, it was just a wonderful, wonderful time. I would wish it on anybody I love. It's an education not available at any university. And then, so I go back to MSNBC thinking, what a great idea. I'm different. We will feature dissent. This is America. Well, by the time the troops were rolling into Baghdad, we were gone. And I want you to know that often, first of all, MSNBC languished, continues to, but it was very, really struggling then. And we weren't Elvis. We did not burn the town down. We were nowhere near the power that we had with my syndicated daytime program. But we often led that network. We were often the highest number of MSNBC in the evening. The New York Times has reported this, so this isn't Donahue bragging. I want to say again, we didn't kill him, but we certainly, the numbers did not warrant our cancellation. They warranted support and promotion and nourishing. We could have been the tent pole for the evening schedule. And it became clear that a memo was leaked, and the New York Times published the memo, which essentially a consultant said, Donahue's anti-war stance will not survive, cannot possibly do anything for you against the flag waving of the competition. Progressive dissent and anti-war people are not good for business. It is not possible to overstate the fear that corporate media has of being identified as liberal. This is very, if we don't understand this, then we really aren't ever going to get anywhere changing this. The president of CNN, Walter Isaacson, on the occasion of his being named, ran to Washington to call on Newt Gingrich and Tom DeBlay and essentially said, we're not liberal. We're not liberal. They are terrified. Liberals, I mean, did you ever talk to a liberal? Liberals, this is management's view. Liberals are wimps. They don't like war. They're not patriotic. They don't support the troops. Liberals are for unions. Unions. Do you have any idea how much the president of General Electric wants to promote a union? Liberals are for gay people. Liberals are wimps. And if they think we're liberal, they're not going to watch us. And not only that, if we support unions, unions are going to want more pay, and that's going to reduce our bottom line, and our stock will fall. The first thing we think about when we wake up in the morning, the price of our stock. So I don't see how, and it's, by the way, this same dynamic obtains to politics. We We'll never, ever take money and corporate power out of politics as long as we have only two parties. Because all they have to do is shower both horses. If they're a win-win situation. Which is why I was on Nader's bus in 2000. We said that all across this country. We said that why does the New York Times own the Boston Globe? These markets aren't large enough to support their own paper. Why does the Chicago Tribune own the Los Angeles Times? Come on. We want more competition. That's the reason for the First Amendment. The whole point of the First Amendment is you have a whole bunch of people gathering the news. Therefore, you have a large crowd, and you're more likely in the collective middle of this crowd to somewhere find the truth. Today, that large crowd, that collective middle, is made up of fewer and fewer companies, larger and larger in scope, much more concerned about the price of their stock than they are about the inelegant, unpopular behavior of sticking their nose under the tent to see what the righteous, powerful people of the state are planning for us. Here we are, the freest nation on earth, and the nation with a media that literally beat the drums for this war. Literally. Bum-ba-dum-ba-dum, countdown, Iraq. Bum-ba-dum. I mean, your heart started to beat. And a week ago, I visited in the home of a 25-year-old Army specialist who took the bullet in Sadr City in March of 2003, which entered in his clavicle, the part not covered by his Teflar, by his flak jacket, and came down and transected the T4 section of his spine. He is paralyzed from just below the nipples down. And that night, I saw this wonderful, this laughter at the White House correspondents' dinner. Laura Bush was so funny. She was. That was a hell of a comedic riff. But I'm sorry, I looked at these people laughing. And you begin to see the separation of the powerful and the media, who have so little time for the people in the streets and fawn over the grandees in the suites. And maybe that's why we've had such a very difficult time to get this nation to think about what it has done with an unconstitutional, unaffordable, underfunded, undermanned, unnecessary, unwinnable war. And a nation that is so largely sitting here mute, watching the bombs drop on crowded cities at night where old people and children are sleeping. And America is sitting here watching this. And so I'm joining. It's so much of a play. It's so great for me to be surrounded by people who agree with me. Really, this is a wonderfully, this is an emotional experience for me. And I thank you. And I'm pleased to pass the baton to these other thoughtful panelists. Thank you very much.
It's a wonderful honor to follow Phil Donahue. That was really fun. Thank you. I had this incredibly naive thought on September 11th, which I made the mistake of committing to print. I wrote a column that for some reason was published in the LA Times called The End of, it was called Game Over, The End of Video Game Wars. And what the column argued was that the experience of seeing the reality of what war looks like, the corporeal reality of bodies, of terrorized faces, the rubble, in such stark contrast to the way we saw the first Gulf, so-called Gulf War, that I thought it would change us, that we would never again be able to look at war as a video game again when we saw those images. And as we now know, and as we just heard, that hasn't been the case. And there was a tremendous effort to make sure that that hasn't been the case. And we've heard a lot about that last night and today. But I just wanted to add one more thing that I recently learned about, which I didn't realize during the invasion of Iraq, which is, as we all know, the Pentagon used embedded reporters. But the television networks were embedded in the war in a much deeper way than that, in that they were part of the war planning years ahead of time. I recently reread the actual strategy book, Shock and Awe, which I would suggest that that everybody read, because it talks about war essentially as a form of mass torture. It says the doctrine of shock and awe warfare clearly states that this is a military strategy that is actually a psychological strategy more than it is a military strategy. That's the awe part. The idea is that you bombard the enemy with such tremendous force that it breaks down their ability, psychological ability, to resist. They are demoralized by your awesome force. But reading this document, I found this really interesting passage, which says, the ability, it's called achieving rapid dominance. The ability to achieve rapid dominance simultaneously through the battlefield will create strategic shock and awe on the opposing forces, their leadership, and society. When the video results of these attacks are broadcast real-time worldwide on CNN, the positive impact on coalition support and negative impact on potential threat support can be decisive. Which is simply to say that if the first attack on Iraq was the first time a war played out in real-time, this invasion reflected an understanding that the playing out of the war in real time could be embedded on a macro level in the war planning. So that the idea was to incorporate the 24-hour news networks into the strategy so that they are projecting these incredibly demoralizing images on the people who are being bombed and breaking down their ability to resist. So we're talking about something much deeper than individual embedding of reporters, but the embedding of the entire news cycle in the war itself. And I think that explains some of those drums of war on a whole other level. I am always struck by the willingness of the cheerleaders of rampant, or what the French call savage capitalism, to break the basic rules of capitalism, i.e. The profit motive, in their suppression of political views. And I think that we sometimes tell ourselves that they won't do that, and we look at somebody like Michael Moore and say, you know, if somebody is popular enough, they will get out there. But I don't think we should be that sanguine about it. I think that there is a tremendous willingness to block out even very, very popular voices because of the broader capitalist incentive to keep these voices out, as we've just heard. I want to just make sure I say one thing constructive and I usually try to save that for the end, and then I run out of time. So I think I'll say it now, which is something that John Nichols and I were talking about last night, which is I think that there is this tremendous potential that we feel at events like this to make media a political issue. We have the facts. We have the political support across the spectrum, as we heard from Amy last night. But I think part of the problem is that the issue is too big. Another is that it often comes off like griping. The other is just the inherent problem of the fact that we only understand, we're so hypermediated ourselves, that we really only understand how to do politics through media. You know, if you have political meetings, say, okay, well, we'll have a protest, we'll call the press, we'll get them to come. Well, what if the protest is about the press? How do we get them to come? You know, there is this built-in problem to making media a political issue. I think there's a real untapped potential out there in military families and returning soldiers, particularly now that what we're seeing is not media beating the drums of war, but a real turning point now where Iraq is turning into, or has really already turned into, one of these intractable ethnic conflicts. Who knows why these people would want to kill each other so much? We're just trying to maybe, you know, keep the peace there. Absolutely incomprehensible and tune outable. This is the way Iraq is now being covered. Yeah, maybe you hear about a blast here, a blast there, but utterly decontextualized from the narrative that we need to hold on to, which is that the United States is the instigator of this violence in Iraq. We are losing that plot. And I think that the talk of civil war is very, very dangerous because it implies that this is an internal Iraqi conflict, not a conflict that was instigated by an external invasion, an occupation. We need to hold on to the narrative, and we need to not let this become yet another incomprehensible so-called ethnic conflict or civil war that is so eminently tune-outable. And this really is a crucial point. And I think that the most powerful people to speak to this are the parents of soldiers in Iraq who turn on CNN to find out whether they're, you know, to try to get news desperately of what's going on in Iraq and are bombarded with the Michael Jackson trial. I mean, can you imagine anything worse? Or soldiers who come back and they want to know about their friends who are still there, who were there thinking that they were making a sacrifice that their country actually cared about, and then find out that they're more interested in the Pope's funeral or Terry Schiavo. These are the people who can speak to this very, very powerfully and with a tremendous moral force. And I think we should think about how to build those bridges and how to build a campaign of returning soldiers and military families saying, tell us the truth about the war. Because there's a way in which it's much harder to tune them out than it is to tune many of us out. So that's my little pitch at constructiveness. I'm going to talk a little bit about this new experience that I've had over the past couple of years, which is abandoning the world of print for a little while and trying to make a documentary film. I made a documentary film with my partner, Avi Lewis, called The Take, in Argentina, and it's about workers who occupy their factory and turn it into a workers' cooperative. It's part of a very large movement in that country. 200 factories have been occupied and turned into cooperatives in this way, spreading very quickly across Latin America. And it's really the sequel to, you know, we see glimpses of really an incredible democratic movement sweeping that continent. Not a U.S.-managed, color-coded democratic revolution, but masses of people in Argentina, in Bolivia, in Brazil, now Ecuador, throwing out their neoliberal governments and demanding a deeper kind of democracy that includes economic rights as well as the right to cast a ballot. These aren't movements against democracy. They are demanding a deeper and more meaningful kind of democracy than they got when their countries made a negotiated transition from dictatorship to democracy that included inheriting the debts of their dictators and shackling them to International Monetary Fund and World Bank austerity measures, which I have to say, with all due respect for Seymour Hersh last night, when he said that the World Bank, at least they don't kill people, they kill people. They kill people, and we see it very clearly in that continent, and that's precisely what is being rejected. So in Argentina, they had this incredible movement where they threw out 5 presidents in 3 weeks, but they didn't have anybody to propose. It looked like a revolution. It smelled like a revolution. There was tear gas in the air, and there were millions of people in the streets. They were storming the presidential palace, and there were helicopters, carrying presidents. It looked like a revolution. But unlike, say, the Velvet Revolution, where they were like, okay, let's put our guy in power, they didn't have a guy. And they didn't have a political party that they were proposing. In fact, their slogan was, all of them must go. And it worked. So they go through 5 presidents. This is in December 2001, so for obvious reasons it didn't make merit too much coverage in this country. But it was an amazing moment. And so they go through 5 presidents, and then they look at each other and go, well, what are we going to do now? And so there was this explosion of grassroots democracy where, when I arrived in Buenos Aires shortly after this, or in the midst of this uprising, you'd walk around Buenos Aires at night, and there would be meetings of people on every other street corner, in every plaza, in every park, clusters of 200, 300 people voting about what they were going to do to fix the immediate problems in their neighborhood. Most of these meetings were dominated by women. They were dealing with very concrete issues. But they were also starting to develop a political program. And that's where the Occupied Factory Movement, that's where it grew out of. We decided to document this process of what would happen, what would be proposed in the rubble of this failed model, out of a feeling that the journalistic drive to just pile on the negative evidence wasn't really getting us anywhere. Seymour Hersh last night said, the truth is bad enough. And we actually have a tremendous amount of indictable evidence, impeachable evidence. And I think that we still feel as journalists that we have to just go out and get more of it. And I don't think that we're confronting deeply enough the psychology behind what makes change possible. There is a point at which so much bad news, so much evidence of corruption, so much evidence of violence, when it is combined with these shows of outrageous impunity, i.e. there is a total severing of causality between the exposing of corruption and any kind of political accountability or change. In fact, quite the opposite. You have these shows of, I can do anything. I can appoint Alberto Gonzalez to be the Attorney General. I can, let the Marine off the hook who was caught on video shooting a prisoner and apparently shot 3 of them dead in that mosque in Fallujah. Last week, that guy got off. Sanchez got off for Abu Ghraib, even though he signed a memo allowing the use of dogs, signed his name to it on September 14th, 2003. And they did an absurd investigation into the shooting death of Nicola Calipari, the Italian security agent who was traveling with Giuliana Screna, such an absurd investigation that even the lackey Italian government had to say, we can't sign our name to this. It's ridiculous, because they exonerated all of them. At this point, the impunity that we're seeing is really part of the show. It's, we can get away with anything. So in that context, just giving more bad news, I don't believe is a catalyzing. I think it's important, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it is always catalyzing. There has to be, we have to also be telling stories about how change happens, which I think particularly for my generation and younger is a really mysterious process. We are so hypermediated that we see change now in these video moments that is, you know, the wall falls and then communism collapses. And we see it on TV. That's the story. That's our understanding of how communism collapsed. Wall falls, Burger King, MTV flag, communism collapse. And we see this in this narrative about bringing democracy to the Middle East. It's sometimes called the tsunami effect, the idea that there can be a managed media moment. Saddam's statue will fall. That will be our Berlin Wall. Then the people of the Middle East will see this on television, except not on Al Jazeera, because we'll close that down. And we won't have to organize or do any of the messy work of political change. It will be a completely media-managed tsunami where everybody at the same time will get the same idea, and this mysterious process of change will take place. So what we wanted to do with our documentary was sort of counterbalance this by showing change happen. The real nitty-gritty of, okay, how are these factories being transformed from capitalist factories that were bankrupt, where everybody was laid off, into democratically run, worker-managed, viable business cooperatives? How does this happen? So we followed it at absolutely every stage, through the court process, through the very first meetings, through the fights with police, through the tense meetings, through people at home with their families and all the tensions at home. And the idea was not to say you can do this exact thing where you live, but to demystify change. And what we see when we show the film is that we're starting to see with documentary films, particularly when they're shown in theaters, that it's starting to have some of the consciousness-raising role that I think Phil Donahue just described, that television has been able to play in the past but has really abdicated. Now we have Oprah, who just tells people to buy stuff, doesn't tell people to, you know, call their congressperson, but harnesses that same power to buy some new cosmetic or whatever. Documentary film is for the moment filling this gap where it's not just that we're going to the movie theater to find out what we're not hearing, what we're not seeing on the news. That's happening too. It's almost hearkening back to the early newsreels where people would go to the cinema to find out about the war. I mean, that was sort of what happened with Fahrenheit. But it's also that people are enjoying the process of gathering together. We've had the experience of showing our film on television. It was commissioned by Public Television in Canada, by the CBC. And that was nice, and it was kind of funny to have an occupied factory, a film about an occupied factory intercut with car commercials. And people said, you know, we saw it, we liked it, but we much preferred the experience of showing it publicly and having discussions afterwards, because it immediately turned into, why aren't we occupying abandoned buildings? Why aren't we, and turning it into affordable housing? Why aren't we occupying unused land and turning it into community gardens? The spirit, the sort of slogan of the movement in Argentina is occupy, resist, produce, and that can happen anywhere, and it can be retrofitted to all kinds of contexts, and it is being. So that experience of gathering together and watching and then acting, watching, talking, acting, is an incredibly powerful combination. And it can work on television, particularly in the context of talk shows where you have a kind of a town hall context. And I think that's part of the reason why instead of that, we now have extreme makeover reality television shows, and the narrative is the exact opposite. It's not let's talk about your life and what we can do about it. It's everything about you and your life sucks. That's our starting premise. We're throwing it all out. Let's go to the closet. Let's bulldoze your house and start from scratch. Very different message. There's a power in stories. This is where I'll end. There's a power in stories, and it's a power to show us how to make change, but it's also a power to heal us from shock. Therapists call it narrative therapy. It's completely accepted that if you have been through a traumatic event, either directly or vicariously, that really the only treatment for it is to tell a story, is to put it in the context of a story that makes sense to you. And at its most basic level, that is what we in journalism do. We talk about what we do as stories. Write a story, did you read the story? But in fact, they aren't stories. They don't use any of the real methods of storytelling anymore. You don't actually meet people. You don't actually have a narrative arc. You just have information thrown at you. That power, I believe, is one of the most powerful tools that we can reclaim, the art of storytelling. Because that isn't about speaking truth to power. It's about speaking to one another and about our lives and making sense of our lives. Because when we are sane, we are powerful.
John Nichols.
I love Naomi Klein. So I'm going to take a long time after this speech to try and reconcile the concept that when you are sane, you are powerful with George Bush. But that's not really our topic today. I was thinking as Naomi spoke about, because those of us who talk a lot, we actually write speeches and things, and then we get the paper all around in front of us, and we're ready to go. And then somebody says something more interesting than what we were going to say, and so then you have to riff off that. So let me begin with Naomi's point about Latin America and bring it home to the reality of our media today. About a week and a half ago, and I still, the other crisis of being a working journalist is you're doing so many things, you can't always write about every absurd thing that happens. And my favorite thing of the last couple of weeks was a USA Today headline. Now, USA Today, which I refer to as a weather page wrapped around the dead, rotting fish they call news, is not a publication I read that often. But I stumbled upon it at an airport or someplace, and I'm an editorial page editor. I tell you people what to think. And so I went to USA Today's editorial page and the headline, and I couldn't make that. You cannot make this stuff up. I know people read The Onion for a laugh, but The Onion's not as funny as, if you're not a kid, you don't know The Onion, but it's a satirical paper. The Onion's not as funny as USA Today. The headline on their lead editorial was, Latin American Democracy Stumbles. And then they detailed all the things that Naomi was talking about, and they actually had a little, one of those little grade boxes, so, because if you don't really want to read the editorial, you just look at the little box that gets you the important points. And they had a list of all the examples of how Latin American democracy was stumbled. And several of them were that there was an election in Uruguay, and they elected the left. And, there was an election in Argentina, and they elected the left. And there was an election in Venezuela, and they elected Hugo Chavez.
Nine times.
And they were actually listing elections and saying, these are the examples of democracy stumbling. And they were putting it in the context of Bush's Iraq stuff and all, there's glorious things happening around the world, but there's some real problems in Latin America because those damn people are holding elections and they're electing the wrong people. And I didn't really know what to make of this. I thought for a second, well, maybe I should call them up and tell them, boy, wait till you see the elections in the Middle East after we get done over there. But then I thought to myself, these are the kinds of things that really get me angry. And I know we have a multi-generational audience, so this would be irrelevant to some of you people, but I grew up in punk rock and new wave. And one of my favorite bands was a British group called Dexys Midnight Runners. And Dexys' first single, there's one guy laughing there going, oh man, I know that. I think I remember that. And Dexys' first single, they had the two guys in the band, and this is all just on audio, going through a radio dial, and they hit an old Deep Purple song, Smoke on the Water, playing, and then they hear this, and they go and they get Margaret Thatcher talking, right, and saying how we're going to have to do something about Ireland, you know, and then they get an ad for some kind of, you know, horrible like beans or something like that, and finally you hear this crash, and the leader of the band yells, "Hey Jimmy, hey Al, for God's sake, tear it down." And that's how I feel about our media today. For God's sake, tear it down. It is a disaster. Now, I did not start this way. We had a little bio here. When I was 10 years old, I rode down the main street of Union Grove, Wisconsin, population 900. And I went to the office of the Union Grove Sun newspaper, where Carl Kruger was the publisher, editor, reporter, printer, ad salesman, and everything else. And I said, "I have read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. I have seen Woodward and Bernstein's work on Watergate. I realize that a free press is the essential underpinning of American democracy. I'm reporting for duty." And to give you a sense of how big Union Grove was and how powerful the press was, Carl looked at me, 10 years old, having arrived on my bike, and he said, "Go cover the school board." And I did. I got $5 a story, $2 more if I took a Polaroid picture in focus. When I was 11, the height of my journalistic career, I interviewed Hubert Humphrey, the former vice president of the United States who had arrived in Union Grove to seek our votes in the third of his presidential campaigns. It was quite, I'm sure it was the low point of his long political career. It was, as I said, the high point of my journalistic career. And I have practiced the craft of journalism ever since. I love journalism. When I come to a town, my friend Bob McChesney will tell you, I buy every paper in town. And, you know, I get the stack. When I drive across the country, I'm a horrifying car guest because the back seat starts piling up with all the papers. Every time we stop for coffee or something, you know, I buy like five more papers. I got to look at them all. I'm just radio, I'm tuning, you know, a whole bit. I love journalism. I love this craft. And yet, this craft is indefensible today. It is so awful, so cretinous that, you know, I move with my beloved fellow journalists, all of whom I respect, and Linda Foley, got the biggest crush on in the world. But I move among my colleagues, but I realize that we are the, you know, the guards in a prison. We're the, you know, we're just the people that are doing the most awful imaginable work, because we are not doing anything that Amy was talking about last night, that Naomi or Phil was talking about what it ought to be. And so I want to talk to you for a couple minutes about that and then take your questions, which are so much more important probably than anything that we say. And I want you to understand that the biggest lie that is told is that the press was always bad, that it was always a disaster. The fact was, it always made mistakes. I'm still waiting for the correction on the Vietnam War and Gulf of Tonkin, just like everybody else. But we had a better media system in this country. It worked better. Orville Schell actually referenced it. You know, this notion that you find a problem, you'd address it, and you'd do a story about it, and things would happen. I once talked to a state legislator. I edit an editorial page in Madison, Wisconsin, among other activities. And she said, you know, your paper, the Cap Times, used to come out at noon. It was an afternoon paper. Said we'd read the article, and then we would get together and write a bill to address the story that you'd done an investigation on. And the next day, we'd introduce it, and then we'd have a hearing that day, and sometimes we'd pass it the day after. You know, that was a reality of how a lot of media worked. We forget that, imperfect as it was, flawed as it was, we had a better system in this country. So what happened to it? I think Tony Benn, the great British parliamentarian, always says that the most powerful thing you can do is to talk about recent history. Because the ancient history has all been, it's been written and reflected upon and done again. What's happening right now, you know, we're in the midst of it. But it's recent history that gives us the power to understand that link between the ancient, what was, and where we are today, and how to do something that affects tomorrow. And so the last 25 years are the time that we should look at, and it is a horrific record. You know, it is in the last 25 years, more so than at any time in our history, that media, corporations, entered the field as a lobbying force and began, not for the first time, and Bob McChesney has written wonderful books about what they did in the 30s, and those, but as a full-time, permanent lobbying force. And with a bigger, and I always tell people, people don't know this. In Washington, D.C., if you took the entire Right to Life lobby and the entire pro-choice lobby and the entire National Rifle Association lobby and the entire Anti-National Rifle Association lobby, and you put them all together, and then pick a couple other issues, put them all together, their number of lobbyists does not equal the number of lobbyists on any given day that are there from the big media companies. They permeate that city. Campaign finance reform has failed not because the people didn't want it, not because the politicians didn't want it, but because media corporations didn't want it because they wanted to keep the revenue stream of all those ads. When you start to unlock the reality of big media power as a lobbying force, you realize it's dominant, it is oppressive, it is overwhelming. So what have they gotten in the last 25 years? They got not deregulation. These people don't want deregulation. You know, they'll say, oh, yeah, we want to free things up. We love the free market. They hate the free market. They see the free market like Dracula does, you know, a stake in the, you know, or the sun in the early morning. It's not, you know, if you think there's a free market for our media, I invite you to go out, find the most powerful television station in town, and then throw up a signal on that same set of airwaves. Find the most powerful radio station, throw up a signal where they're at. You will find out. We have a pretty regulated media in this country. The FBI will show up at your door, and they will say, no, no, no. These are your airwaves, that's true, but the federal government has decided that this guy gets that airwave, you don't. And if you put up a pirate radio station, you're going to the same jail as well. So the bottom line is we have a hyper-regulated media in this country. It's just regulated for one set of folks. We have decisions made behind closed doors, in our name, but without our informed consent by the FCC and by our Congress. They eliminated the Fairness Doctrine in 1989. Think about that year, 1989, Fairness Doctrine gone. What did eliminating the Fairness Doctrine do? It meant that when you put a message on a local radio station that is damning, you know, it says Phil Donahue's just the biggest thug I ever met, and, you know, he's done some pretty awful things, and, you know, he's a communist. And, you know, I put that on, and Phil used to be able to come down to the radio station and say, you know, it's true, I am a communist, but I'm not a thug. And so I want to go on air, and I want to talk about that. I want a couple minutes to just respond and say, you know, a couple things, because my family's listening, and I'd like them to know. That's eliminated. That's gone. So what happens when you get rid of it? Well, it's interesting. A guy started his radio show, his national radio program, in 1989, the year that they got rid of the Fairness Doctrine. His name is Rush Limbaugh. He was able to go on nationwide, say what he wanted, and one of the marketing things they could do with local radio stations is say, you don't have to let anybody respond to this. It broke open radio for right. You want to know where did right-wing talk radio come from? It came from the reality that a syndicate could say to local stations, they don't have to worry about whether it's saying something bad and that folks might want to respond. Eliminated the Fairness Doctrine. Redefined the role of the FCC, Federal Communications Commission. You know what? It's a public entity. It's supposed to work for you, doling out your airwaves. It became, and not that it hadn't been this in many ways over the years, but it became solely the place where decisions are made between two companies. You know, I want this set of airwaves. No, 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 I want it. Well, the airwaves are free. They belong to the people. So you can't, it's one place you can't buy it. So what do? You lobby the FCC. They become, you know, this sort of like they become the gang boss, right? They decide who gets what territory. Well, we're going to give you this piece of town. You can take that piece of town over there, but you can't fight with each other. And of course, the small number of corporations, well, that works for me. That's good. I'm still going to have my turf. You're going to have your turf. We need somebody to make sure we don't fight too hard in this free market. So the FCC redefined. Then comes the Telecommunications Act of 1996, right? You know, the Telecommunications Act 1996 comes along. Clear Channel owns roughly 40 stations nationwide. You can only own two stations in a town, an AM station and an FM station. Suddenly, Clear Channel, less than a decade later, owns 1,200 radio stations. And on the day after September 11th, they send out a memo to their radio station saying, people are pretty upset. They're not going to want to hear certain kinds of songs, songs that will, you know, stir them up and make them think the wrong things. And on that list was John Lennon's Imagine, because we certainly wouldn't want people imagining a world at peace. Incredibly powerful companies taking over huge portions of our airwaves, made possible not by the free market, not by your decisions, but by government decisions about how we divide up our media. And these changes have created the most consolidated, most formatted, most dumbed down, and dysfunctional media in the history of this country. Our media is worse than it has ever been. Bob Dylan said, let us not talk. Let us not talk falsely now. The hour is getting late, so we ought to call the question. Can freedom of the press survive media consolidation? The subject of our conference. Answer, no. It cannot. It's not about freedom of the press. We didn't put freedom of the press into the First Amendment because we cared about people who publish newspapers. It's about democracy. Freedom of the press is in the First Amendment because the founders of this country believed you could not have a democracy without a free press. James Madison quoted earlier, and very good quote, but he had another quote about media. 1822, he wrote to his friend W.T. Barrie, a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power that knowledge gives. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, comrades, we are unarmed. We have wonderful alternatives. We have Indie Media. We have Amy Goodman. God bless her. Carry her wherever we can get her. We have WILL here in this town. We have a wonderful infrastructure of Indie Media. But the fact of the matter is, it does not begin to rival the power of mainstream corporate media, which dominates the political discourse of this country, and that for people who are not in this room but who do vote, gives them the information that allows them to decide, make those informed decisions, on whether we go to war and on who we make our president. James Madison said, tragedy or farce or both. I would suggest to you, and I'm not going to go into the details, but let us remember the coverage leading up to the war in Iraq. Let us recall one incident. There's thousands. You could go on and on. The hyper-patriotism, the little flags waving, the pins. If you know, Fox News at one point, they had an anchor on complaining because he was saying that, you know, people on ABC weren't wearing their flag pins anymore after September 11th. And so we had the hyper-patriotism. We have all the stenography to power. The president gives a last press conference before the war. No tough questions, not a single detailed question. Dick Cheney appears on Meet the Press on the Sunday before the war starts and says, we will be greeted in the streets of Baghdad with flowers. Right? Never called on the question. All of these lies, all of this obvious deceit. And, you know, why did the press not question it? Was it because we didn't know? Well, golly, everybody in Europe seemed to get it. The Guardian newspaper asked. They said, you know, why is America the way it is? They had an answer. They said, maybe it's the papers they read. It's the truth. We were rendered uninformed, unarmed, at this most critical point. One incident. Came home on a Friday night after the war started. My wife and I, we turn on the television set. We're Wisconsinites, that's what we do. And we watched Aaron Brown on CNN because we wanted to have serious news. We didn't want Fox. This is a time, we're in a time of war, you know, it's a serious moment. So Aaron Brown comes on and he says, we're about to show you an image that's very troubling, that many people, many of our viewers won't want to see, but we feel that in this critical moment, you have to see all the things that are going on. So we know some people will be offended by this, but we think it's important to reveal. show you. And, you know, we make no comment on it. We are just reporters here. All this apology. I thought, oh, my God, what are we going to see? And they went to an aerial overhead view of an anti-war demonstration in Chicago. A peaceful anti-war demonstration where people were marching through the streets of Chicago, 7,000 of them. At least they got covered. Then a couple minutes later, Aaron Brown said, you know, if it touches the earpiece, that's when something's really heavy. He says, oh, we've got something coming in here. We're going to go straight to Baghdad here. We've got some images for you. And it was one of those bombings where, you know, they got the little tracer rockets and everything. But it was morning there, you know, and they were bombing along the river. And I've been to this part of the world, residential neighborhoods. And no preparation. No, you might be troubled by this. This might bother you a little bit. And so I thought, well, let's do the alien test. Right? The alien arrives in the spaceship, says, what's going on, guys? And we say, hey, come on over to our house. It's Friday night. We're going to watch TV. And we get some pizza, maybe a little beer, turn it on. We're watching Aaron Brown. Aaron watches the alien watches the report, hightails it back to the ship, flies back to his distant planet. They say, what was that Earth place like? And he said, it's a very troubling place. They seem to be really bothered by people who say, thou shalt not kill. But they don't have any problem with killing. That's what our media is making us. It is making us that lie, that unreality. And this war is tragedy. 1,500 dead Americans, 25,000 injured for life, more to come. 100,000 Iraqis or more dead. Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, tragically injured. An economy destroyed, a region in chaos. Tragedy. Now, farce. The election of 2004. The biggest issue of the election. Biggest issue. What John Kerry did in 1969, we need to know. Right? We spent a whole campaign season talking about what John Kerry did in 1969, not what John Kerry might do in 2005. We had no debates. We had no discourse. We had the most vapid, insipid coverage of two candidates who admittedly weren't saying much, but maybe if you had a fourth estate, they might have asked one or the other of them a question. They might have actually pressed him to do more. Maybe they would have even let Ralph Nader into the debate so he could have shaken things up. But no, we had this empty, vapid campaign, and we had a farcical result, the re-election of a president who had been exposed for his obvious lies, his obvious support for torture, for other forms of terrorism, a man who couldn't possibly be re-elected by a decent, moral, well-thinking people. So are the American people immoral, indecent, not well-thinking? No, they are not. They have experienced what Madison warned us about, tragedy or farce or both. We have both. We have the tragedy. We have the farce. Now the question is, what are we going to do about it? And the simple reality is that we are doing something. This conference comes on the eve of the National Media Reform Conference in St. Louis. Some of you will be there. If you don't have your ticket, I suggest that you take Curtis Mayfield's advice. People, get ready. There's a train to come and get on board. Come on down to St. Louis and be a part of this movement, because we are going at the belly of the beast. We are taking on not individual reporters who want to do their job. We're backing them up. We're not even taking on those editors who Seymour Hersh talked about. We are taking on this media system, and we are saying it must be torn apart and fundamentally changed. Let me close with one quick thought and then your questions, and that is, people will say, well, you know, look, this is too much to ask. A media that's nurturing of democracy, a media that encourages ideas, a media that calls us to a higher ground. Yes, it is a daunting task, but I will suggest to you that it is no more daunting than the task founded by James Madison and the founders of this country when they took on the most powerful king in the world. It is no more daunting than a civil war to end slavery. It is no more daunting than a New Deal to loosen the shackles of economic slavery. It is a daunting task, yes, and yet it is every bit as necessary as those previous struggles. If we do not fix this corrupt and broken media system, we will not pass a democracy on to our children. The struggle is as basic as that. your involvement is as necessary as that. We have tragedy. We have farce. Let us put the end to it now. Thank you.
We have 25 minutes for questions. I have been threatened that we have got to end at 12:30. There are two mics on either aisle. What I'm going to ask everyone to do is to be brief, to ask your question as briefly as you can so that we can get as many questions in as we can.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question of the panel on a subject that hasn't been discussed in this conference on media consolidation, which is the increasing number of multiplexes and independent theaters. I'm the manager of an independent theater in town where we showed Fahrenheit, we showed Control Room, we showed The Corporation, and I'm probably the only one in town that has seen the take because I requested a screener. And I'm wondering, has anyone else in the room seen Naomi's movie yet? And the reason the rest of you haven't is because we haven't shown it yet. We were one of the only theaters in our region that was able to show Fahrenheit. And there's two forms of media that haven't been discussed so far in this conference that have to do with independent distribution. It's great when you can make these forms to discuss what's going on in our society, but independent bookstores and independent theaters, these are forms that get the media out, and I was wondering if you guys could talk about these issues.
Let me quickly take it just to say, Robert M. La Follette, the great progressive senator from Wisconsin, when asked about any issue, always said, it's the old fight between the powerful few, the elites, and everybody else. And the simple reality is that when we talk about media reform, we do often focus on the news, a little too much probably, often to the exclusion of the culture. You know, the reason there are so many musicians involved in this movement, the reason Patti Smith is coming to the Media Reform Conference, the reason Billy Bragg and Steve Earle and others have played with it, is because musicians understand the damage that's been done to radio by formatting and things like that. We're even worse about talking about film and books. The fact is that it's all the same crisis. We have figured out how to dumb everything down to do everything at the cheapest possible price. And then we have built the regulations and the infrastructure to support those who are dumbing down and going to the cheapest possible price. And we undermine independent media all over the place. We undermine distribution networks. Independent bookstores are closing left and right across this country. Independent theaters are having a terrible time. And so when we talk about media reform, it's a shorthand. The thing that you need to understand is the way that we want to break this up, the way that we want to get this up, is not to get everybody involved in things in Washington. We want you to go to your hometown, and we want you to do two things. Number one, you know, obviously pressure your elected representatives up that food chain of politics, but two, support your independent media on the ground at home, and there are many ways to do that. One way to support it is to go to this theater, to go to the bookstore, to do these things, but another way to support it is to get on your local cable board, get on your local zoning boards. Understand, you know, the right wing is smart. They know that sewer treatment is a political issue, right? They figure out a right wing take on it. Well, there's a right wing take on zoning and there's a left wing take. And a left wing take on zoning doesn't create the zoning for a multiplex theater that puts this woman out of business. When we take media issues and we apply them broadly at the local level and we begin to say, we want to create results that are good, not the results that favor those who've got all the power now, we begin to break the cycle. And so I'd say that's the truth of the matter. The other truth of the matter is that, thankfully, people like Amy are doing these films, which is giving you things to show. And the nice thing is we have such a corrupt and rotten big media system that there is that space for the independents. We just have to give them all the support we can.
Do you have something you want to add?
Yeah, I agree with that analysis, certainly, and in this country, you know, I'm Canadian. I don't know if anyone has mentioned this. I don't actually live in this country. It's sometimes when I hear this, I just want to leave, and remind you that there is another option. My family came to Canada during the Vietnam War, along with 50,000 other draft-age Americans. We built the healthcare system. We supported public media, supported the National Film Board of Canada. That's where my mother worked in making documentary films. And our film in Canada got a totally different kind of distribution than it did in the United States. And, you know, we have this experience over and over and over again. I mean, this was a mainstream film. In Canada, it was on the main television network, a feature film, primetime slot, and we also got theatrical simultaneous release in multiplexes across the country. We got the same thing in France and Italy. A lot of that is because there's policy to set aside a certain amount of the culture protected from American media. So they have to, and this is where the American media lobbyists spend a great deal of their time lobbying internationally to erode our cultural protections to make sure that we have some media space that is protected from the huge Hollywood films and American network news. So I guess that's the only thing I could add beyond just backing up what John said about absolutely supporting our independent bookstores and our independent cinema, because they really are certainly the only place where my books are sold in this country, and absolutely the only places which have shown our film in this country through a great grassroots network of independent cinemas. And everywhere we've gone and showed the film, we've heard people hanging on by a thread, about to close because they're facing tremendous pressures. And in fact, there's consolidation within the independent cinema field, where you now have chains of so-called independents that are becoming more and more corporate. So where you have a genuinely independent cinema, you must go out and support it. It's also fun, and you'll see great films.
Last night, I learned from Naomi Klein's talk that the main function of terror is not of torture is not to extract information, but to terrorize the population. And this morning, I woke up to a news story that in Afghanistan there was an enormous demonstration yesterday, hundreds of thousands of people. And the police waded into the crowd and killed people, wounded people. The reason for the demonstration? A Newsweek story about torture in which they featured flushing the Quran down the toilet. And this was the response. And then I thought of Naomi's talk last night, and I said, was this story embedded in Newsweek? I know they didn't intend a gigantic demonstration, but even the news person engaged the reporter with the question, well, how did they hear about this in Afghanistan?
I didn't hear about the story. I have to say it doesn't surprise me. You know, I think we need to know, we need to be aware of how much strategic leaking is going on. But I also think we need to be wary of seeing everything as planned. You know, within so-called conflict zones, or theaters, as they're appropriately called, theaters of war, you know, there is certainly the element of planning, and then there's also just the element of chaos. When I was, my last day in Baghdad last year, I went to Sadr City, and it had just been bombed the night before. We went to the headquarters of Muqtada al-Sadr in Sadr City. It had been partially destroyed. The outer walls were destroyed by a Bradley. They drove right through the walls. Two missiles had been fired through the roof. I saw the missiles. They were American missiles, obviously. Craters in the floor. But that wasn't the most disturbing thing that I saw. They asked us to come inside. I went inside with Andrew Stern, the photographer I was working with. And they said, look at this, look at this. And they showed us two copies of the Quran that had been shot at point-blank range. The soldiers got out of their Bradleys, went inside, and assassinated the Quran. Did someone plan that? There's so much rage. It's this rage at their own ignorance. I think that's what the rage is about. It's facing an enemy that they don't understand, that is fueled by a force that they don't understand, and then you see these raw expressions of hate, an assassinated Quran flushed down the toilet. But that said, if you read the torture manuals, what torture is supposed to do, the CIA torture manuals from 1963 and 1983 declassified, is it's really a strategy of total isolation. What you try to do is you try to shrink the world of your prisoner, okay? And they say things like, there should never be a phone in an interrogation room because you don't want there to even be the suggestion that there could be a communication with the outside world. One of the ways that people communicate, in fact, the primary way that people communicate with the outside world in jail, in Afghanistan, is through prayer. That is the link with the outside world. So when you hear these stories about female interrogators in Guantanamo touching prisoners during Ramadan, things like that, and then turning the water off, what that's about is severing their communication with God to shrink their world so they're totally isolated and broken. The idea that they would flush the Quran just fits that, in my view.
This side.
I was interested in John's comment about Ralph Nader being shut out of the debate, and I was just wanting to ask a question more about the general notion of what constitutes debate in our media. You could call it sort of the illusion of debate, as exemplified by things like Crossfire, you know, thinking about John Stewart's appearance on Crossfire. Or even the presidential debates themselves are another example of this. I'm English, as you can tell, and when I go back to my country, I'm always struck by there's a certain level of debate that you see on news shows where a politician will appear with, and the guy asking the questions will be quite sort of snippy and prickly and quite at times even sarcastic. And because I've lived here so long, I'm surprised by this because I'm like, how could he be so mean to that nice politician who's come on his show? And I was just interested in what is it about the media in this country that you think sort of flattens the debate or creates this sort of this puppet show, this theater of debate with no real questions? Tony Blair, of course, is required once a week to stand up in Parliament and defend himself against, you know, whatever, answer questions. Is that part of the problem?
Or? It's a terrific question. It's why Americans who really, you know, look, we fought a revolution against the British to get rid of them, and yet we still watch Question Time on C-SPAN because, you know, we want to see at least some politician answering a question. But the structures, I'll give you a long, long answer on this, but the simple reality is that we've got a couple of horrible things going on. First off, we've concentrated ownership of media so much that, you know, in the White House press corps, where you used to have, you know, somebody from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and somebody else from the Chicago Tribune and somebody else from, you know, all papers all over the country, had this room packed with all these different reporters, and some of them came from liberal papers or some of them came from right-wing papers, and they, you know, they had sort of agendas, and that was good. Reporters with agendas is a good thing because they ask tough questions based on their agendas. And so the concentration of media really squeezes a lot of that out. Celebrity journalism squeezes a great deal of it out too, especially the TV emphasis, because you can ask the president a snippy question. You might be able to pull it off, but then you're not going to get Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice or Dick Cheney on your Sunday news show where you want them. You know, the White House does a parceling out of questions. And also, we've lost a sense of solidarity within our journalists. When Ari Fleischer stopped taking questions from Helen Thomas, the senior member of the White House press corps, the White House press corps should have walked out and said, no, we do not allow discrimination against a member because they ask tough questions. But I will close with one suggestion to you, and that is go find the transcript or the tape, Bob and I write about it in our next book, of the interview that George Bush did before he went to Ireland with the reporter for Irish television, who had to submit her questions in advance and then sat down to interview the president. This was last summer. And she asked her questions, and the president, who had been prepped, didn't answer them. He gave standard American spin. And she kept interrupting him and saying, no, Mr. President, I need you to answer this question. This is what I'm asking you. And he would go off on his spin, and she said, I need you to answer this question. And finally, Bush, angry at her, said, we don't do it this way in the United States. That is the simple reality. We have trained not just our journalists, but our presidents to expect soft questions. They are shocked when they get tough questions. Why would we not expect that the American people get their mind warped into believing that, this is, that what we get is journalism? It is not.
Back to the
side. And we should bring in for 1 second the guy who was with Nader trying to get him in the debates.
Well, I last got off the bus in 04, and it wasn't easy. I did sign the statement that asked, in 2004, asked Ralph not to run. And this was a very painful thing for me. It helped that I was on the same list as Howard Zinn and other heroes of mine. The taking over of the presidential debates from the League of Women Voters by corporate America is, in my view, one of the most grievous assaults on information and free speech in the history of presidential politics. Let us understand. If you're not on the debates, you're not taken seriously. You can't possibly win anything if you're not on the debates. Ralph Nader could have gone to every city of this nation and spoken in every public square and still not reach the number of people who watch the debates. And the people who decided who got on the debates were Paul Fahrenkopf. Is that his first name?
It's Paul? Frank Fahrenkopf.
Frank Fahrenkopf and Paul Kirk. Fahrenkopf is the leading lobbyist for the gaming industry. Gambling. He's a lobbyist. Fine. I do not think he should be executed for this.
Not now.
It's legal. But he's a businessman who represents business interests as well, and so does Kirk, the chairman of the Democratic Party. They're lobbyists, and they decide who got on this. This is unbelievable. And it became a show. It's a show sponsored by Anheuser-Busch, American Airlines. Can you imagine how much these business people wanted Ralph Nader on that debate? And that's why third rails are never touched in debates. Presidential debates are thin beer. Never touched single payer health insurance. Never go near it. Never touched the racist drug war that is causing children to be shot in the crossfire with white cops knocking down doors in black neighborhoods. Freeze! In Boston, they did it. Roxbury, the guy got up, he ran, they caught him in the hallway, pushed him down, face down, he aspirated, and died of a heart attack. They had the wrong apartment. City of Boston apologized, paid the widow $1 million. This never came up during the debates. The only thing that comes up during the presidential debate every 4 years, and it's going to happen again in 4 years, are prescription drugs for seniors. And the reason is because seniors vote in a high-concentrated voting block. And not to diminish this, very important issue. But what about all the other issues? When Kerry sat down after getting the nomination, I know, I wasn't there, but I'll bet you, he is surrounded by Bob Schrum and all the inside baseball people, and they got in his face and they said, "Don't mess with this war." And everybody in this room who thinks that's a real stupid idea have to ask themselves, if Kerry had opposed this war, would he have won?
Yes.
No. I'm not that sure. I am not that sure at all. I think an anti-war candidate will win, has a very good chance in 08. But America is not ready to be humble enough to acknowledge the swaggering mistake made by a Republican president while the Democratic Party hid under its desk. We aren't, you know, that's the insidious nature of war. You know, if you oppose it before you war, you're not a proud American. If you oppose it after the war starts, you don't support the troops. If you oppose it after the first soldier dies, then you're spitting on the grave and dishonoring the sacrifice. It is unbelievable. And And the drumbeat to shut up and sing is deafening. We must understand how powerful this card is in how it paralyzes democratic, real democratic debate and information that should be getting to the people. We have to understand this. It enabled the Republican Party to characterize Bush as a patriot and John Kerry as some sort of war wimp. It's unbelievable what they were able to do. This is the insidious nature of war as it plays out in a political campaign. And we must never let this happen again.
It strikes me when you talk about the media system, what's question came to my mind is, what's behind it all? How did it get this way? Has it been inevitable? Is it a particular thing in the United States? Is it related to the system? How did it get this bad? Why did it get this bad? Big question.
It's not actually that big a question. There's a thing called capitalism. And, you know, if you take away the rules that make children play nicely with each other. I see this lovely child right behind you there. And if you take away the rules, I hate to tell you, but you know, I've read some of these books where kids turn out pretty bad and do some pretty nasty things. Well, capitalists are a lot like that. They need rules. They need lines drawn around the tennis court so they play within them. And our media system gets dramatically worse when we, the citizens, are X'd out of the process and make no requests and make no demands upon it. And when our elected representatives do not, in our name, put those demands, we lose a fairness doctrine. We get Rush Limbaugh, right? We lose the cap on radio station ownership. We get a memo that says, don't play Imagine by John Lennon after September 11th, right? We put a Republican in charge of PBS, and we lose Bill Moyers. You know, I mean, the simple realities are, that's what happens when you get a concentrated media without an ownership that's responsible and without a government that is putting basic demands upon it in the name of the people. And the core answer to your question is this. Look at other countries. Our media system, not an individual paper, but our system is worse. How do I know that? Because I don't think Americans are the worst people in the world. And yet, if you look at polling before this war that Phil just talked about, everybody else in the developed world understood that it made no sense to attack Iraq in response to September 11th, and it made no sense to claim there were weapons of mass destruction. There weren't. Everybody else got it. Americans didn't. Are we stupid? Are we, you know, evil? No. It's like The Guardian said, it's the papers we read. We have a media system that is so rotten at its core that it's because we took the rules off. We have no demands upon it. We don't fund our public broadcasting, and we don't demand that the private sector live up to certain basic democratic and civic responsibilities.
Anyone else on the top?
Chorus Line won a Pulitzer Prize. And one of the reasons Chorus Line won a Pulitzer Prize, in my opinion, is the wonderful song sung by the little girl from Heartland who goes to New York and she wants to be a star and she wants to be an actress and she's got a wonderful voice and she desperately wants to become part of art. And she comes out on the stage toward the end of the play and she laments, tits and ass, what you see is what you get. That's all they want to see. So you have a corporate, and that, therefore, Jerry Springer. Therefore, how many talk shows with half-dressed teenagers? My daughter is a slut. It sells. I mean, I'm not pretending to tell anybody this or inform you of anything. And as long as corporate media is in charge, and as long as the bottom line is king and the price of the stock, we should at least understand that, as the little girl in the play makes clear, this is why it's awful. This is why it's awful. And we have a, we have a nation that's dumbing down. We have a nation that's not, I just want to tell one quick story. In 1985, I was in Moscow with my friend Vladimir Posner. We had already done the space bridges. And I was surrounded by Moscovites with the ear set, you know, simultaneous translation. I said, this is 85. Gorbachev came to power in April of 85, and we did our space bridge in December of 85, and then I went over with the Donahue Show. So it was early 86. If you could come to the United States, where would you like to come? Hands went up all over the room. And I ran over, you know, Las Vegas. One guy said, Disney World. And a woman stood and she said, Oxford, Mississippi. And I said, why? She said, William Faulkner. And in my ear, I heard the translation, because that is the home of your great author, William Faulkner. And I wondered how many Americans knew that. They were much more interested in us than we were with them. Americans' vision stops at our shores. We have not raised our children to care. And media is closing its bureaus internationally. I was watching Canadian television, Bill Cunningham. I've never met him. I like him a lot. And it was on the International News Channel, and he was doing Ceausescu, Romania after Ceausescu. And I thought to myself, can you imagine CBS Evening News? Coming up, Romania after Ceausescu. Never. Never. Because, like, you know, what you see is what you get. They want TNA. They don't want, there is no interest in Romania after Ceausescu. So we're in this. But media is too. And Bob McChesney makes this point in much of his writing, much of his wonderful scholarship. You know, America's a lot like the woman who didn't know she was married to a drunk until one night he came home sober. You know, we don't know what kind of media we could have. Ralph Nader makes this point. We're all corporatized. We don't know what's possible because we've never been exposed by a media that's from the bottom up and filled with diversity and ideas and not afraid of dissent.
Naomi? Yeah, I just wanted to add a little something. We've talked about the narrowing scope in media and bookstores. One thing we haven't talked about is universities. And I think, you know, because we're here, and actually I think increasingly rare for a university in the United States to have a conference that looks like this one. And I think it's going to get rarer and rarer. So, first of all, I think the university really should be applauded for not giving in to the incredible cowardice. This is the next target, and it's already pretty well advanced. And you know, there's all kinds of stories. When I speak on U.S. campuses now, half the time I'm introduced with a disclaimer. Universities, particularly liberal arts. Colleges and departments are now seen, they have control over the media, and they're trying to get control over the universities. They already pretty much have it, but what we're starting to see is just this really weaselly self-censorship stepping in, and the media really, media workers really, really paved the way by showing that we could censor ourselves much more effectively and much more zealously than we have to be censored from the outside. And that's what we're starting to see universities do at the same time. This is a particular problem because I think that when we think about how to cope and act in these moments, I think one of the greatest forces that we have to, and I'm sorry to keep coming back to these questions of psychology, really is fear. How are we going to stand up to fear? Because fear and shock, the shock of September 11th. This administration understood before it even happened, and I'm not one of these people who actually believe that they planned it, but I believe that they're incredibly expert opportunists. So it was in the doctrine that they, you know, in the project for a new American century, that they needed a Pearl Harbor-like shock to the system in order to push through the policies that they wanted to push through. I'm not saying that they planned that shock, but they recognized it when they saw it. They're doing the same thing in tsunami-struck countries right now. They didn't plan the tsunami. They didn't do the tsunami. But as soon as it happens, it's incredible the speed that the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund moves in and uses the dislocation to push through these policies. So one of the things that I've been studying recently is what makes societies immune or resistant to shock? And it's interesting because after September 11th, there was this really strange thing that happened in this country where Americans ran out and bought books about Islam. Mm-hmm. Now, some of it was absurd, like people going out and buying the Quran. As Mahmoud Madani said, he doesn't go out and buy the Bible to understand, you know, the invasion of Iraq. Part of that was that people were being fed that this is a religious war, so, you know, go buy the Quran. It's that, on that level, it was ridiculous. But the impulse, which was, I need to understand, I need to have a narrative to understand what's happened to us, was an extremely healthy one and a correct one, which was immediately undermined. In fact, we were told that to seek understanding, to seek a narrative, is to justify terror, to talk of history, to put this event in any kind of historical context, is to betray the victims, and so on. Now, what's interesting is two examples of countries that had a shock and responded not with fear, but by standing up to fear and coming up with real solutions. One is Argentina. The uprising that I described earlier, these huge protests where they threw out the president, what actually sparked the protest was Fernando de la Rúa. There was looting in supermarkets in the suburbs. And after the currency crashed. Fernando de la Rúa went on television, the president, and he declared a state of siege. And he said, there's chaos in the country, there's a curfew, everybody stay home. And people watched this, and they remembered the history of fascism and dictatorship in their country, and they said, no, not again. And they flooded into the streets, banging pots and pans. And when people talk about this moment, what they say is, what he was doing by declaring a state of siege reminded them of the first moves of the military when they moved in, and they weren't going to let it happen again. And they described those protests as a collective standing up to fear. Something similar happened in Spain after the Madrid bombings, which was a terrible shock to that country. And it could easily, if this was this country, have been used to exploit Aznar's, you know, Bush-like policies, the fact that he was in Iraq, fed their own domestic war on ETA and so on. Instead, what happened is that people rebelled against the use of what they identified as fascist language. They said that Aznar was reminding them of Franco. This is, and once again, people stood up to fear. They elected a left-wing government that was promising to pull the troops out of Iraq. They thought, they responded sanely. But what's interesting about both these cases is it was a knowledge of history, in each case, very clearly, a knowledge of their own history. You know, this country has its own history of quasi-fascism that we don't remember. So when you hear of Muslim communities where people don't want their names on any list, it doesn't trigger, well, that's McCarthyism, because people don't even understand their own history of blacklists or of the Japanese internment. I mean, so I think that the attacks on academia also have to play a part, because who's going to teach us this history? And do we ever hear history professors on television putting these events in context? No, we hear clashes of civilizations and so on.
And unfortunately, we are out of time. And sorry.
Sorry.
I just want to thank the panelists.